us, we actually get some real dialogue and some real answers going. I've got some stock answers I continue to throw out: rent control and the sleeping ban, community control of police. But we really need to fine-tune all this stuff. We need to hear the specifics. We need to hear your reactions to these ideas. And we need to have people to implement these ideas and to make sure that they actually become more than just rants on the air. And that's going to happen because the community decides to take some action on this issue. And the community, believe me, is you. You're the community. So 427-3772. The issue that Ed Davidson was talking about before he hung up about another Mercy Housing project, and believe me, there are so many of them around town, it's hard to count them all, is a resolution forgiving a loan of $31,000 to them. He's been pointing out that Mercy has not been managing well, and it's spending lots of money in administrative fees that are being rubber-stamped every year by the city council without any real oversight. There was this original loan had to do with the 612 Washington Street apartment, a five-unit dwelling, and I actually had on the line earlier a woman who lived in that dwelling, and she had a number of concerns about the management, and also she had some charges of nepotism, that is to say of folks giving special privileges and favoritism to relatives, and I'm going to be inviting her to air those charges more fully at a future show and give those who she's accusing an opportunity to respond. I think we're talking about the Fosters here, David Foster and the relatives of his who currently live in Mercy Charities housing. So that's going to be an upcoming show. We're going to be talking about that. You notice I am naming names. There's no secrets here. We don't have closed meetings, Scan. We don't have closed meetings, Green Party folks. We don't keep these things behind closed doors. We give people an opportunity to talk about them, to deal with the issues up front. And we'll be talking about these issues in a show coming down the road. We're also going to try to reach on the phone Attorney Ed Fry, who has been in court filing an appeal with on an issue of folks evicted from a Mercy Housing project. And we've actually talked about this project a couple years ago. It's a trailer project. I'm going to try to get him on the line. I'm getting a busy signal. Hopefully, maybe he's trying to dial us at the same time we're trying to dial him. We'll take an opportunity to pause briefly and hope that maybe he can get through to us, or you can get through to us. 427-3772 is the phone number. Here's an AP Wire article, came over the internet from Tucson. Advocates for the homeless criticized the city council for banning newspaper hawkers and other vendors from city street medians without first finding the vendors new jobs. The bottom line is that these people don't want welfare, they want to work, said Brian Flagg, manager of the Casa Maria Soup Kitchen, which serves the homeless. Flagg spoke at Monday's city council meeting, and that I guess would have been late March, at which Councilman Jerry Anderson said not enough was being done to help place the hawkers in new jobs. The council approved the ban in October. It begins May 1st. Newspaper hawkers work for Tucson Newspapers, Inc., which handles circulation and other business functions for the separately owned Tucson Citizen and the Arizona Daily Star. So these are big newspapers, not the monthly street newspapers you see in Santa Cruz, Street Spirit, sometimes Street Sheet, and occasionally the Street Shit Sheet. Karen Thorson, the city's community service department director, said city staff was working with Tucson Newspapers Incorporated and local social service agencies to try to place the hawkers in new jobs, find them housing, and get them mental health services if needed. Thorson said social service agencies have contacted 33 of the 41 hawkers and that 7 have been receiving mental health treatment, 2 have been placed in new jobs, 13 didn't return after an initial meeting, 11 were given referrals to housing and job training services, and 2 of these undertook job training. Flagg argued that the hawker ban should be delayed until the city can replace the hawkers' jobs. You need to come up with 50 jobs before you wipe people out of the jobs they have, he said. Councilwoman Carol West, who sponsored the drive to enact the hawker ban, said further delay would be counterproductive. If you keep putting off the day, these people will keep putting off the time they need to look for employment, she said. Anderson, meanwhile, criticized TNI, saying it was more concerned about the loss of revenues from the hawker ban than from the hawkers themselves. Story from Tucson about banning people selling papers from median strips. City street medians, which frankly is just another attempt to gentrify the area and remove the eyesore homeless people. I would bet dollars to donuts that there were no stats of any accidents or anything of the sort. I saw a similar kind of process happening in both Palo Alto and I think Mountain View. And they did successfully ban them in one of those two cities, and they didn't have any stats on trip and fall or accidents. It was just they don't want those folks out there in a public place in that way. Here's a story from the Sacramento Bee. Homeless fight county. Homeless advocates need to talk. Who can lay claim to McClellan Inn, the hotel on the closing McClellan Air Force Base? Is it Sacramento Cottage Housing Incorporated, a transitional housing program for the homeless, or McClellan Business Park, the private developer for the base that wants to incorporate the 118-room hotel into a conference center? Homeless advocates say they have the rights to the property. They suggest the county is double-dealing. Reality is a little more complicated than that. To meet the federal guidelines that required local governments to give priority in base conversion plans to charities that serve the homeless, in 1998, the county signed an agreement with Sacramento Cottage Housing to convert McClellan Inn into a transitional housing facility for the homeless. A nearby pizzeria also on the base was to be operated as a job training site for Cottage Housing's formerly homeless clients. The county also agreed to provide base facilities to the Sacramento Food Bank Services and the Wind Youth Center for Homeless Kids. The only condition on the transfer is was that the charities had to demonstrate reasonable expectation of their proposed project's fiscal viability. Should the county find them viable, it is required either to turn the property over to them or to provide substantially equivalent replacement property or cash, a value the Sacramento Cottage Housing places at $10 million. Since that agreement was signed, the county has negotiated a deal with McClellan Business Park that gives the private developer the exclusive right to purchase all or portions of the base and to participate in all matters that have a material effect upon the use, redevelopment, and marketing of the base. McClellan Business Park includes the McClellan Inn in its marketing materials. Given that Sacramento Cottage Housing officials feared that the county will deliberately underestimate the charity's fiscal viability when it evaluates the charity's finances and thus escape its obligation to them, it's not an unreasonable fear, but the county risks a suit should it do so. Successful redevelopment of McClellan is in everyone's best interest. Protracted litigation serves no one. Now is the time for all parties involved to step back and do what's right and fair for the public as a whole. Sacramento Supervisor Roger Dickinson, who represents McClellan, has made no secret of the fact that he prefers the private developer's plan. But he says there is other housing at McClellan that offers opportunities for the homeless. Homeless advocates should take him up on the suggestion to explore where else on the base they can serve their clients. McClellan is a big place. Surely there is room for all the county's vital interests, economic and social, to be accommodated. And we have on the line with us Attorney Ed Fry.
Hi, Robert.
Free Radio Santa Cruz calling in there, Ed. I know that you were attorney for two people who, should we say, may have gotten a raw deal from Mercy Charities Housing.
Put it mildly.
And I was in court on one occasion observing you defending these folks and observing a apologetic judge, Kelsey, I believe it was, say that, gosh, he wish he could help these people because it did sound like, you know, they Mercy hadn't lived up to their agreements, but he couldn't do anything. Can you give us a background on what happened and where this case is now?
Well, it's kind of an involved story, but basically what happened was these folks were tenants at a low-cost housing project owned by redevelopment, county redevelopment in Soquel, which was slated for a rehabilitation project. And they knew that when they moved in. But they, as residents of that project, they were entitled under federal law to a new unit once the project was completed. Of course, in the meantime, they had the whole place had to be vacated for the rehabilitation project. So they moved down to another little trailer park in Soquel called Heart of Soquel, which was also owned by redevelopment for the interim.
Owned by redevelopment or by Mercy Housing?
Well, it was owned, but the land is owned by redevelopment. Actually, the coach that they were living in was purchased by Mercy Housing because Mercy wanted to use that particular coach to put it back up. At the rehabilitation project, once it was, you know, that was going to be part of the rehabilitation project.
And the name of the original project, I'm sorry, the name of the original project that was called?
It was McIntosh Mobile Home Park, and then after it was rehabilitated, it was to be called Osocales, which is the Indian Native American name for Soquel.
And it looks like they may have done to the tenants what the government did to the Indians, huh?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Anyway, so they were on a rental agreement down in the heart of Soquel, the interim housing. And they, all of a sudden, on October the 15th of 1999, which was about 6 months after they'd moved there, they were told they had to get out immediately, and their new place was not ready for them yet at Osakalas. So they brought an eviction action against them. I mean, my clients had, they were, you know, low income, and they had nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have much warning as to get out. They didn't, hadn't gotten any 30-day notice or not even a 3-day notice. So all this time from, you know, throughout the whole year of 1999, they had been receiving nothing but assurances from Mercy that they were going to get a new unit once it was all ready. The new rehabilitated project was ready. So now comes October 15th, and they boot them out of the, they try to boot them out of the heart of Soquel, the interim housing. And these folks would have to be homeless. You know, they have themselves, man, wife, and daughter.
How old is their daughter?
She's 19, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
She's a college student.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would have had nowhere to go. So we fought the eviction.
Did Mercy also fight it for you? I mean, Mercy wasn't the one evicting them. It was this other park, right?
Well, Mercy was a co-plaintiff along with redevelopment because by then Mercy had purchased the actual coach that they were living in, as I said, and so they were a plaintiff too.
So Mercy was colluding in this eviction action?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
It was Mercy was the one that was behind it, actually. Redevelopment wanted to go along with the plan that was going to allow my clients to go back into Osakalas.
Mm-hmm.
But Mercy was angry at them for not getting out of this coach that they needed back up at the rehabilitation project.
But did they offer them any alternate housing?
Or? That's the thing. They didn't. My clients would have just been out on the street.
But weren't they required under federal law to offer them something?
Yeah, federal law doesn't allow them to just come along and boot them out like that.
Because we've heard the city council here say time and time again that there's no need for explicit guarantees for the Dolphin and Lee tenants because federal law or state law, redevelopment law, requires that anybody who is removed from this kind of a project will get funding and everything will be okay and then they'll be able to go back into the project. Yet here seems to be a case by the same housing provider, Mercy Housing, where that didn't seem to operate the way it should have.
Yeah. Federal law says that for all the tenants who have to be moved out of the project, they get to rent a place at the new project once it's completed. And Mercy said all that means is that they get an opportunity to apply for a new place.
So in other words, this is the same thing we've been saying to City Council, that Mercy's so-called first preference, they say that all the Dolphin Lee tenants that get dumped or that get told they have to move out will get first preference in the new project while their homes are being bulldozed. But first preference doesn't mean they get any kind of guarantee they're going to get in, then, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Did they use the word first preference for your tenants? Or?
Priority. Same type of language, but not that particular term.
Okay.
So.
Okay. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but
no,
I appreciate it.
No, that's,
you
know, that's okay. So anyway, Mercy didn't give them this chance to move back in because they were so angry at them for not moving out of this coach before their new place was ready. So they cooked up this scheme to disqualify them based on prior evictions that they had suffered, you know, before, you know, years before. Because they discovered that by doing some background investigation on them. So they used that as their pretext, but it was a phony pretext. I mean, all along they had given them letters and assurances back as early as January of 99 that they were on track to get their new place at the Osakalas.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden they yanked the rug out from under them on October the 15th because they won't move out and go out on the streets.
Did they also use credit concerns? That's something that we were interested in with
respect
to.
Well, yeah, eviction, you know, is like a credit concern. Prior judgments of unlawful detainer against them.
So did they claim not only that they were unlawful detainers, but that they had bad credit for other reasons?
No.
Just unlawful detainers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to say that low-income people are disqualified because of a prior eviction is just absurd because they're low-income, so they, you know, chances are good that they did get booted out of one or two places before in their lives, you know?
And you presented this in court?
Yeah. And Judge Kelsey was very obviously biased against my clients and in favor of Mercy. Mercy, you know, the people that from there.
David Foster was one of those
David
folks?
David Foster. You know, they were in the same socioeconomic level as the judge, and he was very, you know, sympathetic with them. He put words in their mouths throughout the whole trial. In fact, in my appellate brief, which I just filed last Wednesday, one of the bases that I'm using for getting a reversal of this whole thing is his absolute bias on the judge's part, because he was just unbelievably biased against my clients and in favor of Mercy.
Mm-hmm.
He would put words in their mouth. He would make his own objections to my questions. He would he would make long harangues and speeches about how stupid my clients were and how righteous Mercy is, when actually Mercy was really merciless in this whole situation.
Without mercy, huh?
Yeah. They're run by an outfit called the Sisters of Mercy. That's who owns Mercy Housing.
Catholic group.
Yeah, but I'd rather call them Brothers of the Devil myself.
I won't tell the Pope about that.
Yeah. They were totally cold and merciless against my clients. My clients didn't do anything, you know, to deserve this, except be poor. Of course, it's still a sin to be poor, so that's the problem.
So they were not only that was their interim housing removed, but they weren't allowed back in the final project.
Right, exactly. So
was the final project finished by October 15th?
No, that was the problem. That if it had been, then there wouldn't have been an occasion for Mercy to get angry, and my clients would have gotten their place. But because my clients refused to get out of the coach that they were in, because the Mercy needed the coach back up at the rehabilitation project, my client, Mercy got angry at him.
Well, now, so how long did Mercy tell them that they would have access to this coach? Was there a prior agreement on this?
The thing was, and this is getting into the legalities of it, but when they moved into Heart of SoCal, which is moved out of the original place and down to the interim housing, when they moved in, they signed an agreement that said, this is a month-to-month agreement. That was on the form used by the county redevelopment. Now, month-to-month agreement means you must give 30 days notice if you want to if you want to evict somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It also said this agreement terminates October 15, 1999.
Mm-hmm.
But before that provision, it said month-to-month agreement twice.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That became the question.
There was an ambiguity. Was this a fixed-term lease, or was it a month-to-month tenancy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in their own words, the county characterized it as a month-to-month tenancy.
Mm-hmm.
And then in another part of the lease, it said, you may have to move out of this this unit because of a flood control project planned for this. It's right on Soquel Creek there in the village.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to move out of this because of this flood control project. And that could mean that your tenancy could terminate sooner than 5 years from now. So that put my clients at a little bit of ease about this October 15th termination date.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that put them at ease was they got part of the lease said that they had to give notice whenever they planned to move, even if they planned to move on the so-called termination date.
Hmm.
So
it seemed to indicate that there was a reciprocal no-rush policy here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, when October 15th came, all the other tenants who were in the same situation as my clients, who had moved down from the old project to the interim project,
mm-hmm.
were given extensions. Everybody except my client was given an extension.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it had always been Mercy's policy prior to this time to give them plenty of notice. They had given them actually 90 days notice on the old to move out on the old project, because, you know, Mercy was involved in getting them out of the old project and down to the interim project. They gave them 90 days notice, then they gave them 30 days notice. So the practice and all the circumstances surrounding it indicated that my clients were going to get some notice before they actually had to move.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they didn't even have to move at the end of the 90-day notice at the old place because there were some delays. So they actually stayed a month beyond the 90-day term.
Mm-hmm.
There was all kinds of indications of flexibility here that they weren't going to have to be suddenly yanked out of there.
Mm-hmm. Now, did the other folks who were at that trailer park, who presumably were Were they also given the same kind of assurances that they could keep their interim housing, and did they that they would be allowed to move back into Mercy, or they would get priority, or whatever their phrase was? Was that the similar situation?
Yeah, they were given similar treatment. Yeah.
And were those folks able to move back in, or have you tracked them at all?
We haven't tracked them with a great deal of detail, but I think that they all were able to get back in.
So your client was the only exception. And do you have any explanation for this? Is this some sort of administrative vendetta because of a personal thing? I mean, it certainly doesn't help Mercy's reputation to have this thing dragging on, right?
Right. Well, yeah, it's a vendetta in the sense that they were retaliating against my clients for refusing to become homeless.
These were the only clients that they told to move out of the trailers. Just they wanted this one trailer back?
Yeah.
And they had no other trailers available. They suggested the folks just set up a tent downtown. What was their...
Yeah, they didn't have any suggestion at all for my clients. Just get the hell out.
Wow. And so what happened to your clients?
Well, we cross-complained in the unlawful detainer action, which is a very unusual procedural move because, for the most part, you can't have any issues other than the unlawful detainer issues in an unlawful detainer case. But so they made a motion to strike the whole cross-complaint. We were cross-complaining for the right to go back into the new place, the rehabilitated place, because by the time they were suing my clients, it was clear that my clients were disqualified from the rehabilitated project.
Mm-hmm.
So we cross-complained for the right to get back in there under federal law and also under state equity law.
Mm-hmm. Plus the apparent comments that Mercy had made might indicate a kind of a contract they'd made.
Well, yeah, all of their letters to my clients. My clients had already gone through a 2-application process by July. They had given them their second application, and there had been no indication whatsoever from Mercy that my clients were disqualified in any way. So my clients were feeling very safe and secure that they were going to get a new unit as soon as it was ready. But then come October 15th, they were yanked. Anyway, in the case, we cross-complained, and Judge Yance sustained the cross-complaint against their motion to strike. They moved to strike the whole cross-complaint as being inappropriate. And,
mm-hmm.
But I was able to convince Judge Yance that, you know, this cross-complaint had to do with their right of tenancy and their right of occupancy of the interim housing. So
mm-hmm.
he let it stand. So Judge Kelsey at the trial had to deal with that issue as well as the eviction. Well, he ruled in Mercy's favor on both. So now we're on appeal, and my clients had to move out. I was able to keep them there until March, about March the 5th of 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So
are they still in the area?
Yeah, and they want back in to the new housing project, and that's one of the reasons we're appealing.
And the name of this project that they're being barred from is the
Osocalas,
and that's in Santa Cruz or in Capitola?
It's in SoCal.
It's in SoCal.
Yeah, which Osocalas is the, I believe, Ohlone name for SoCal.
Huh.
That's where the name came from.
And how many people are in this project, you know?
It's probably about 18, 20 units. It's a fairly small project.
Have you talked to any of the tenants there? Are they all pretty happy with Mercy, or do you know anything about that?
I have not gone there, no.
Haven't surveyed them, eh? Well, we have to go down there and do some man-on-the-street analysis.
Yeah.
So you've appealed. What's the... what's the likely timetable for any kind of ruling on this?
I don't expect a ruling for another year, because we just filed. There was all kinds of procedural stuff afterwards. Judge Kelsey was totally uncooperative in doing the things he was supposed to do, in giving the bases for his ruling and all that.
You're talking about Kingfish Kelly?
Kelsey.
Kelsey, I'm sorry. Now, it's Kangaroo Kelly and Kingfish Kelsey. Those are my own names for those particular judges.
Kelsey's now retired, and... not going to be back on the bench much anymore.
Mm-hmm. He does come back for these repeat performances or
yeah.
Bravo appearances or
and
whatever.
He did that when there was a vacancy in the commissioners, you know. But now we have 2 new commissioners.
So now it's not likely we'll see him.
Siegel and Irwin Joseph. So he's not likely to be back on the bench much, except for vacations, I suppose. Other judges go on vacation.
Well, let me ask you this. This has been a matter of some concern to us, concern with the Dolphin Lee and the fact that the city council was asked by SCAN and by the tenants' Residentes Unidos group back last summer to essentially sign a mandate by resolution that everybody living in the Dolphin and Lee apartments before they will be required to leave or before the city will grant money to Mercy Housing or authorize this redevelopment project will mandate that every single person living there as of a certain date will be given a guarantee that they will be allowed back in the new housing, or let's say if they choose to leave, they will be given a sufficient amount of money that they could have spend for 3 years worth of housing they would have gotten. I'm not sure what the exact time period was, but something in essence that would have allowed them to pay for whatever is necessary during the relocation phase of the housing, which could be 1 to 3 years to build it. It sounds like even if they had such contracts signed, those contracts could be ignored or dismissed by a judge like Kelsey. I mean, is that...
Well, if they have actual signed contracts, that's a stronger case than my clients had. My clients just had a lot of written promises, assurances. Well, okay, you're on track for priority consideration, et cetera, et cetera. What they did was they went through what Mercy called a pre-screening process, so that you'll be able to. This is for the purposes of your future planning, your future housing needs, as Mercy put it in those terms. So my clients filled out an application, and Mercy responded by saying, okay, your application looks good, you qualify. However, we'll need a later application because things might change. For example, your income might go up, which could disqualify you.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it gave them the clear impression that as of January 1999, they were qualified, they had their new unit guaranteed. It was only something that might happen in the future that would disqualify them. But then come October and Mercy gets pissed off at them, they go back and look at their pre-1999 history, and they say, aha, we found something that in your past that disqualified
and
you.
And what basis did Kelsey say that this wasn't a violation of an agreement?
Well, he said, well, they never really made a promise. They said they always said they were going to give a future application.
They always had their fingers crossed.
Yeah, right. Totally unfair.
So
totally inequitable.
Would your recommendation to Dolphin and Lee tenants be to get a very clear set of individual contracts before settling back into a warm, comfortable position and hoping you're going to get treated right? Or?
Yeah, clear promise in writing, signed by Mercy.
And by the city, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, guaranteed by the city.
Mm-hmm.
That's my recommendation, because otherwise they'll try to wiggle out of it.
Have you heard anything else from other Mercy Housing clients, either good or bad, that would lead you to think that this was maybe a fluke with your clients, or does it seem to be a policy, or does it happen more than once?
No, I've just stuck with the legal case. I haven't gone out and interviewed people. I haven't had time to do that. I wish I did, but I haven't, so I don't know what other...
We'll have to do that for you there, Ed.
There you go.
We're talking with attorney Ed Fry, who has two clients who seem to have gotten a somewhat raw deal from Mercy Housing as they attempted to follow the rules as Mercy laid them down so they could go out of the trailer court while it was, I guess, remodeled or redeveloped or whatever, and then move back in, and they were not allowed to do that, and that's currently under appeal. For those who want more information, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I'll pass on the information to Ed, although I think you're probably a pretty busy guy with all these appeals. Anything else you want to say on this or any other subject, Ed? I know you yourself have been working on a number of political projects concerned with community power, the drug war, control of police, you name it, accountability for politicians. Anything you want to say on any of those subjects?
Yeah, just briefly. I've been practicing law for about 32 years, and I've run for public office 5 times over those years also. So I've tried to study this both systems, legal and political system, all the way along the way as I'm going. And the thing that I've come up with is that this country needs so badly is a public forum with genuine input by the citizens and direct contact between the citizens and the office holders. In other words, the office holders get their office, the president, the congress members, the senators, they get into office and then they insulate themselves from the public. And they hold these, sometimes they community forums, or maybe they hold a press conference. But these little things are so wired that they don't ever really have to answer the tough questions. They don't have to face follow-up questions. At a press conference, the president can answer a question with a lot of rhetoric and bullshit and then go next, and he goes on to another subject. So that you never really get to, force them in public to answer hard questions. So these retrograde policies that we've put up with for over the decades and decades, like the permanent war economy and the dr- drug war and the lack of health coverage and the degradation of the environment and the schools. All these things go on, and they're going to continue to go on because these office holders are insulated from the public and from accountability. To me, the solution is to make the president go on national television. This is going to require a constitutional amendment, obviously. Require the president and every other office holder to hold individual forums every 30 days in which they'd have to answer the questions from four citizens. In other words, for a half an hour each, the whole thing would last 2 hours. The president would have to sit in front of 80 million people on national television and answer their questions.
Mm-hmm.
The people who would get to be on there would be either citizens chosen by lottery, or if the citizen herself or himself doesn't want to appear, they could appoint a proxy, say appoint Ralph Nader to take their place. Can you imagine having Ralph Nader or Noam Chomsky across the table from President Bush for a half an hour?
I think probably, unfortunately, what would happen is they would sell those spots to corporate people who would ask questions that we wouldn't really care the answers to either.
You couldn't sell them. I mean, they wouldn't be for sale. That would be against the law.
Well, proxies, you know.
Proxies. Well, proxies is the person who would be appointed by the citizen.
Right.
Herself or himself, so.
I like the idea. I'm just wondering how it could be effectively done so that it wasn't corruptible process.
Yeah.
But I think that I favor a local accountability process. I think we should start locally and try and do that. I've often proposed an alternative kind of council meeting where the community gets together and addresses the issues the city council isn't addressing, ranging from the drug war to the sleeping ban. But hey, I know that you've been there on the forefront of both the local issues challenging D.A.R. Danner and his drug war priorities, and also challenging our representatives in terms of their bombing of civilians in Yugoslavia. Both of us were arrested together at several of those occasions.
Yeah, well, I just think that we don't have a lot of time left, so I don't want to start locally. I want to start on the national level because I see the economy, the environment going bad so fast, and the war economy situation heating up to where we're going to have another arms race, and perhaps, you know, with China, where things are heating up. I just don't see that we have a whole lot of time to start on the local level and gradually work ourselves up. I want to put George Bush on the spot. I mean, we've got to make the man
you mean
legitimate.
His fraudulency?
He is an illegitimate president because he didn't get the majority vote. He's an illegitimate president because he won't answer questions of the citizenry.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, in my mind, would give him legitimacy, if he were willing to face public questioning on national television.
Well, is there a number of people who should call you at if they want to talk to you more about this or involve
themselves?
Absolutely,
yeah. I'm trying to get this project off the ground, but I got a huge caseload that I'm having to deal with, so it's hard, you know, to get it moving, but I'm going to be accelerating as summer approaches, so... they can call me at my office, 479-8911, if they're interested in taking part in the project, because it's an idea, I think, whose time has come. You know, it's the only way we're ever going to get people to do the right thing is to embarrass them into doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's our own fault. As citizens, we have sat back and allowed all these things to happen without demanding the right to, face our questions. As citizens, because the citizens are supposed to be in charge in a democracy. We are the ones who are, and yet we don't assert our need for accountability.
We've been talking with Ed Fry, whose number is 479-8911, if you want to get involved with this citizen accountability project, or I should say politician accountability project.
Office holder accountability.
Office holder. Yeah. Very good. Thank you very much, Ed, for giving us this detailed update on Mercy Charity's treatment of at least one family of three.
Okay, Robert.
My mom keeps...
There's my father. He's...
My father?
My father, really.
I think my old fella.
You see my old man?
My old fella.
My dad?
My mum.
My mum and dad?
Me and my mum is...
Me and my dad just...
My mum.
My mum and dad?
My mum.
My mum and dad?
My mum and dad?
My mum and dad?
Yes, sir.
No, sir. Goodbye. Three bags full, sir. Goodbye.
Because the mummies and daddies of the day is advertising. They're really telling you what to do, although you don't really know it. I mean, you walk down the road, I guarantee you don't get 10 yards without there's something advertised. And they're really the mummies and daddies, like that film 1984, Big Brother. They tell you what to do. It's the way it's put over, craftily. Sex is brought into it. You see a girl buy these nylons. You see her showing half her leg. Or you say, smoke this pipe. You see a big handsome bloke, like big muscles, you see? Psychological.
And we're coming up in the last 20 minutes of Bathrob Spears Broadsides. Now's the time to call in if you want to be a part of this show in terms of questions, answers, or thoughts. 427-3772. On April 12th, the City Council Coffee Klatch, or actually City Hall Coffee Klatch and Tag Team Teach-In, goes back to court. The Coffee Klatch 3, that's me, Becky Johnson, Bernard Klitzner, accused of harassing Anna Brooks, administrative aide to Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice. Mayor Fitzmaurice, we have subpoenaed, asking him to be there to answer some questions. We believe Fitzmaurice is the real evil genius, if you will, or dumb shit, if you won't, I'm sorry, the real person behind this lawsuit. And we think that it's a politically motivated lawsuit designed to avoid discussions of the sleeping ban issue. And the sleeping ban, of course, is that law that makes it illegal for homeless people to sleep outside, criminalizing 1,000 to 2,000 poor people every night, Municipal Code 6.36010A. Here is the brief that Attorney Kate Wells filed. I'm going to read a bit from it. In response to Mayor Fitzmaurice's attempt to avoid being forced to testify on April 12th. And that's what he's going to argue on the 12th, that he shouldn't have to testify because he's a public official, he doesn't know anything, he's a busy man, and it's not relevant to the argument that we are harassing Anna Brooks by, according to her declaration, requiring change for a $20 bill for a 10-cent copy, let's say, or stealing a pen. She has a number of allegations. Certainly a theft is a criminal behavior, and one would think that would be the basis of a complaint to the police department if you're really serious about stealing a pen. But we've been through this before. We think that her allegations essentially amount to an attempt to get rid of us from the offices because we're a nuisance or an inconvenience to her and Mayor Fitzmaurice. But since it's a First Amendment issue, since it's more than an inconvenience to have police harassing you late at night if you're a homeless person, in fact, it may be a life-threatening kind of behavior. People die because they don't have access to support services, because they don't have access to the police, because they can't sleep in groups. This is documented. Then the real issue has to be changing the political agenda. And regardless of how timid certain Green Party people are about bringing these issues forward in a timely fashion to a Green Party mayor, some of us have felt you have to bring these issues up. And that's what we've done. That's what we're doing. And on 8:30 in Department 6 on Thursday, April 12th, that's where we'll be. Here's the brief. Responding to the mayor's attempt to avoid a subpoena. It's called Defendant's Memorandum of Points and Authorities in Opposition to Tim Fitzmaurice's Motion to Quash Subpoena for Appearance. Introduction. In early December 2000, defendants, alarmed at the number of homeless deaths and frustrated at their continued refusal of Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice to place the sleeping ban ordinance on the City Council agenda for public hearing, decided that the homeless situation was of critical public concern and directed their efforts at lobbying the mayor and other council members. It is undisputed that their actions were peaceful and directed toward the mayor and City Council members. Repeatedly on a daily basis, defendants attempted to meet with Mayor Fitzmaurice to try to persuade him to place the sleeping ban on the agenda. Mayor Fitzmaurice steadfastly refused to meet with the defendants and instead, numerous times, scolded them for being there. He actually told us to leave. Mayor Fitzmaurice refused to engage in any dialogue with the defendants regarding the sleeping ban. As the lobbying effort continued, Mayor Fitzmaurice became increasingly more hostile toward the defendants, telling them they had no business being there and demanding that they leave the office. Never once, though he was asked on a daily basis, did Mayor Fitzmaurice agree to meet with the defendants in any way or engage in a dialogue other than order them to leave. After a period of time, Mayor Fitzmaurice instructed Plaintiff Brooks to take notes about the defendants' presence in the offices and in certain instances actually told Brooks what to write in her notes. See Declaration of Bernard Klitzner. According to Linda Esperanza, a teacher at Bayside Children's College, she met with the mayor along with five or six students ranging in age from 7 to 17 during the time when the defendants were pursuing their lobbying efforts, at which the mayor became hostile and aggressive in a manner that was, in her opinion, not appropriate in front of the children. The mayor's hostility was directed toward the defendants, in particular toward Robert Norris, who the mayor described as not being able to count to four. Argument. A. The mayor was a daily percipient witness to the behavior of the defendants. These are the arguments as to why the mayor should be forced to testify at the hearing coming up that will show that we were not harassing Anna Brooks, his administrative aide. Although the mayor would most likely be a hostile witness from the defendant's perspective if allowed to testify at the trial, he would also be forced to admit truthfully that the demeanor of the defendants was peaceful and directed towards lobbying efforts against the sleeping ban. Additionally, there are specific instances where the mayor scolded defendants for speaking loudly. Defendants refute these allegations and have audio tape recordings to play at the trial, and assuming that the mayor would repeat these allegations on the stand, defendants are entitled to confront the mayor with these audio recordings to refute such damaging allegations. In other words, we have the tape that shows that the mayor's claims, as he made to the Metro, that we were talking at the top of our voices throughout the afternoon, are essentially complete fabrications. And we would like to be able to have him there so he could respond to our tape and say, oh, well, that was a phony tape, or, oh, I must have been wrong, that must have been another day, or whatever he would say. B. Defendants' lobbying efforts were directed at the mayor. Although defendants made it clear to Anna Brooks and to the mayor that they were seeking to meet with him to request that the sleeping ban be placed on the city council meeting agenda, despite daily written requests, the mayor steadfastly refused to meet with the defendants. The mayor's testimony is important to discover if Brooks passed these written requests on to the mayor, and if so, why he refused to meet with him. In order to end the lobbying effort, the mayor held the key. Defendants have the right to elicit testimony from the mayor regarding his refusal to meet with them. C. Defendants contend that the injunction was initiated by the mayor in order to avoid addressing the issues presented by the defendants. Repeatedly, in front of Anna Brooks, the mayor chastised the defendants and berated them for their efforts. The defendants have the right to show such hostility by questioning the mayor with the intention of showing that it was the mayor's attitude, not any harassment or interruptions, which caused Brooks to file this injunction. Additionally, it is the defendant's allegation that it was the mayor who initially instructed Brooks to start keeping notes regarding the defendants, and in certain instances actually told Brooks exactly what to say in her notes. Since the mayor is in a position of authority over Brooks, his testimony in this issue is relevant and material. Defendants also contend that he made up allegations about them that simply were false. Defendants have the right to elicit testimony from the mayor to prove these contentions. It would be prejudicial to the defendants to be deprived of the opportunity to discover exactly what conversations he carried on with Brooks and whether or not he encouraged Brooks to file this injunction, not because of any interruption of Brooks' work, but because the mayor was tired of hearing defendants' message and wanted to stifle defendants in a way that would not implicate him or the defendants' First Amendment rights. D. Another reason that Mayor Fitzmaurice should be forced to go to this hearing and answer these questions. The cases cited by the mayor in this motion are distinguishable. All the cases cited by the mayor in support of this motion to quash involve circumstances where the person subpoenaed had no personal knowledge of the facts in the case. In the case of Knight versus Superior Court, the court cites authority for the fact that, and here we have a series of cases that the city attorney on behalf of the mayor has said show that he shouldn't have to go, but those cases are different than this case, because in this case the mayor was a witness and knew what was going on. E. There are other remedies available to the mayor. The mayor makes the point in his memorandum that the subpoena should be quashed because he might be subjected to questioning on issues such as his feelings about the sleeping ban or other political issues. While it is not the defendant's intention to elicit any testimony from the mayor that is not relevant to the injunction, the appropriate remedy would be to object to such a question at trial and let the judge rule on the objection. This is not a reason to quash the subpoena. In other words, if the mayor is afraid that we're just going to ask him questions about the sleeping ban that have nothing to do with the injunction, the attorney for the mayor, the city attorney, on our money, I might add, can simply object, and that can be dealt with at the trial. Failure to tender payment of $150. This is another thing that we didn't do. Apparently you have to pay the mayor $150 if you want him to come. He is, after all, an important guy. While it is true that defendants have thus far failed to tender witness fees to the mayor, such fees will be paid to the mayor in full prior to the trial. This case has been a tremendous financial hardship for defendants thus far. While Brooks is receiving representation by the city attorney at the taxpayer's expense, defendants have been forced to hire attorneys to defend them in this action. While the filing fees were waived for Brooks, defendants, in order to file their opposition, had to pay $400 to the court. The subpoena should not be quashed for failure to pay witness fees. Conclusion. It is the defendant's contention that the real reason for the issuance of this injunction, which bars myself, Becky Johnson, and Bernard Klitzner from being within 50 yards what is that, a football field or two football fields, I'm not sure, but it's quite a ways away from the city council offices, unless we are engaging in official business, and even then we can only go to other offices, not to the offices where the city council records are kept, not to the offices where the city council members regularly meet people, not to the offices where the city council regularly holds its closed sessions, though it must be conceded they have moved those sessions in the past at our request. So this is the injunction that we are currently under and is being considered expanded for three, count them, 3 years. It is the defendant's contention that the real reason for the issuance of this injunction was Mayor Fitzmaurice's desire to stop defendants' activities in peacefully petitioning their government for redress of grievances that are of great public concern. Since defendants' activities are solidly protected by the First Amendment, the mayor was forced to find some way to curtail defendants' activities without violating defendants' constitutional rights. Defendants contend that the solution was to use his authority to prevail upon Brooks to file this injunction. For the foregoing reasons, Mayor Fitzmaurice's motion to quash the subpoena should be denied. I suspect it won't be, because the judges here are partial to their city officials, at least many of them are. But we'll see, and I encourage you to see, too. This is going to happen on 8:30 in the morning on April 12th in Department 6 down at the courthouse. Come on down. If you can't come on down, give a call to City Hall, 420-5017, and tell the city council to stop this injunction and to end the sleeping ban. Strike the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance, which make it illegal for homeless people to sleep either in vehicles or outside in a situation where there is both a rent emergency and a shelter emergency. Particularly important because on April 15th, the Winter Armory shelter closes, leaving space for only 28 people out of that 1,000 to 2,000 who can go indoors or even sleep legally. Finally, here's something that might interest you. This is a declaration from Linda Esperanza. This is a woman who is going to be present at this court trial, or at least her declaration is. She is the, well, I'll read you her declaration. I am a teacher at Bayside Children's College. Although I do not know the exact date, sometime in December 2000, one of my colleagues at the school made an appointment to take some of my students to speak with Mayor Fitzmaurice in order to show them that they did have access to city government. I was accompanied by 5 to 6 students from ages 7 to 17, and we were shown to the mayor's office to speak with him. At some time during the dialogue, the subject of homeless issues arose, and Mayor Fitzmaurice became verbally aggressive and showed great agitation. He brought up Robert Norse and showed by his words and attitude great hostility towards Mr. Norse. At one point, Mayor Fitzmaurice stated that Robert Norse does not know how to count to 4. It is the defendant's contention that the real reason for the issuance of this injunction was Mayor Fitzmaurice's desire, and I think I'm actually reading the same thing again here. Sorry. My dear. This is what happens when you have things printed on both sides of the page. Well, that, unfortunately, is all of her declaration that I seem to have here at the moment. So if you want to hear what the rest of it is, you're going to have to come down to court on April 12th, although we will be doing a report on the court for those of you who are working people or like to sleep late, and that will be happening at our next show, 6 to 8, on Thursday, April 12th. So that's another opportunity for you to hear what's been going on. You can also, as I said, call City Hall at 420-5017 and tell them, politicians down there, it's time to start dealing with some basic human rights issues locally rather than simply being poster children and making public presentations and sounding off on issues that are thousands of miles away. Although there's nothing wrong with doing that, it doesn't seem to mean much if you're not dealing with keeping your own house in order. I had some interesting stuff I was going to read to you from the book Lies My Teacher Told Me, because on Monday, I believe that my old associate Just Man Jim Costner, the man the Free Radio Santa Cruz Collective loves to hate, is going to go back to court. That's one of the reasons I call this station somewhat Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Damn it.
Yes. And we have the next talk show host is in accord with my free speech policy, is speaking freely behind me. He's going back to court in San Jose, I believe it. I believe at the moment Costner is a fugitive, but as I understand it, he's scheduled to turn himself in tomorrow in San Jose. And there will be, in fact, a forum on political prisoners and the sleeping ban on Thursday night, April 12th, same night, the morning of which we'll be going to court. On that evening at 7, from 7 to 10, there will be a forum that everyone's invited to at the Veterans Hall. I know that Skidmark Bob will be there to keep order in case any rowdy Free Radio people start sounding off. No, just kidding. I know the Free Radio folks are quite well-behaved group, perhaps a little too well-behaved. Who knows? In any case, so that's 7 to 10 on Thursday, a forum on political prisoners. If you want more information on this, check out the Street Shit Sheet. That's a homeless newsletter which has come out recently and has been is distributed downtown along with Street Spirit, which I have the new April issue. If you're interested in giving me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, you can get a copy of that issue or go out to the Homeless Services Center or the Community House, the Page Smith Community House, where I'll be leaving some copies tomorrow or the next day. And I am, of course, taking off shortly for the Rage Against Rent and see if we can actually do some real raging against rent and not just cheerleading for Fitzmaurice, Dolphin Lee. As you say, we see we have real free speech here. We have Tim's backer in the studio behind me, or actually, I'm not sure if he's a backer or a front man. I'm not sure. We did invite Mayor Fitzmaurice to call this show, by the way. So had the good mayor been interested in responding to any of these concerns, he would have had the option to do so, as he does every Sunday from 11 to 1:30 when we come on the air, and every Thursday from 6 to 8. But unfortunately, the mayor was occupied or chose not to respond to this golden opportunity to put you-know-who in his place. I think it's really unfortunate because... I'm getting a kind of a pressure from one of my free Radio Santa Cruz companions. He was just talking, actually. He's talking about the mayor having to go, right? That was it. You're talking about the mayor.
Yeah.
The mayor has to go. We have a quick phone call here.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk for like 35 minutes about nothing. Let's just take over the next show. I want to hear some music, man.
You have 20 seconds in which to express yourself.
I want to hear music, man.
Well, we got the music man coming up. That's the vicious Skidmark Bob, who's going to be reading
Skidmark
kids' fairy tales.
I hear he like got the hots for me.
I'm sorry, this is
man.
Emma Bob.
Skidmark Bob?
My name is Emma.
His name is
Emma.
Emma. I guess that's...
Is that Emma?
We're going to leave you now, and we'll hope to see you next time. Take care of yourself, Merlin.
Always a pleasure to have those loyal repeat callers. Gosh, here I am. I'm here with all my debris, and I guess I'm packing up and ready to take off. I will be heading out.
How's it going, Robert?
Not bad, Uncle Bob. Heading off to the Rent Rage Rally.
Where's that happening?
Well, that's happening down at Lee Brandt and Raymond Streets, and I encourage you to keep telling people to come on down there. But remember, bring your magnifying glasses with you, and don't fall for a lot of scan spin, as I put it.
Is that going to be in the park there, the Beach Flats Park?
I believe it will be in the park. And
that's probably the only legal area you'll be able to be.
Well, I'm going to try to, maintain my bona fides. As you know, the Green Party, and I have been... Oh, there's another announcement. The Monday Morning Group, and you can mourn for the Monday Morning Group, meets tomorrow, Monday morning, at Baker's Square at 8 o'clock. The only proviso is Robert Norse is not allowed to come to those meetings. So if you want to be in a Norse-free zone...
And again.
Hey, man.
We're working on something here, too.
The Free Radio Collective is on top of it, folks. I mean, they don't want to be the last to catch up with the general sentiment. So
I was supposed to serve you some papers, but...
Hey, those who serve also stand and sit and broadcast. So it's an opportunity for you. That's Baker Square tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. The issues have to do with the planning for a town hall meeting in July. Michael Schmidt, Dan Alper, Lydia Blanchard, perhaps Linda LeMaster, Thomas Levitt, a whole bunch of otherwise well-intentioned folks concerned with ending the sleeping ban who have, to some extent, unfortunately, unleashed their rage against poor Uncle Robert here because of his suggestion that they should really deal with the sleeping ban and not a variety of other homeless issues that have nothing to do with the subject. But they will be there tomorrow at 8 o'clock. And here is another phone call. This better not be Merlin. That's all I can
say. Rage against Robert.
And hello there. You're on Free Radio.
I have just a few words of rage against Robert.
Excellent. Go ahead.
I think just to respond to some of your last comments.
We didn't start the fire.
That's not my fault. I didn't do that. Go ahead.
I think that you are, and I say this with, with the utmost of respect for you and the work that you're trying to do, but, with a big but.
Uh-oh, I've got a big but. I agree with that, yes.
And I'll say this and be quick.
Go ahead.
Because I know you're moving on there.
Mm-hmm. You hurry it up, caller.
You can be one of the most divisive activists I've ever heard, and it frustrates me sometimes to great lengths. It frustrates me because I know that you care deeply about the issues that you
got
are
10
working
seconds,
on.
Wrap it up.
And unfortunately, though, you end up putting people off, and it's unfortunate. That's all I want to say.
Thank you, Benny.
Bye.
And for all of you who have been put off, or perhaps for those of you who haven't been put off, give a call to 423-HUFF, 4833, to engage in more disruptive and rancorous exchanges, or possibly some friendly exchanges. I try to do a little of both, and sometimes that can't please everyone, but hey, why try, as they say. It's important to try to do what you need to do, and I hope all of you are doing that out there. Don't please your neighbor, but really talk to your neighbor. And get down there to the Rent Rage Rally and...
Right.
Whoop it up, because now it's time for the rather deep-voiced Emma, who is coming on to, shall we say, red-hand it up. Thank you for being with me, and shall we say, Emma, do you have anything you're going to be putting on here? I think you're going right into the turntable, so see you down at the, we'll find out if they work, at the Rent Rage Rally.
Oh, look what I found out here in the backyard. It's fuzzy and crawls like it's going somewhere. When I open my hand up and ask you my question, you thump me and holler, don't bring it in here. I had me a thought that I wanted to tell you. I had an idea I wanted to share. But you make me feel